1947.
Good morning. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. It's a program where we expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion, politics, and patriotism, as well as with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'll try to help you understand why these things are happening, share what we can do to protect ourselves while predicting what these events portend for our future. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His covenant and through His Torah teaching, ultimately striving to replace religion with reason. Our phone number for those who would like to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is spoken on this program today is 877-376-45. And for those who would like verification, particularly of the statements and message that is presented in the second half of the program, or even to understand the motivations for exposing religion and politics, economic schemes, and military endeavors in the first half of the program, I would invite you to go to introtogod.org, yadayah.com, prophetofdoom.net, or questioningpaul.com. We were doing a rundown of America's tax and spend policies and the correlation between taxation and deficits, even between Democrats and government spending. Between the inception of the Federal Reserve and the income tax in 1913 through the 1950s, I think that was on Thursday of last week. And we're going to review some of that material, adding considerable information to it so that we have a strong foundation from which to evaluate economic malfeasance by both parties and the ultimate destruction of America financially and economically in the last 20 years in subsequent programs. And then, of course, on Friday, we had the pleasure of being able to speak with Craig Smith, who shared his insights as an economic historian on the consequence of the federal income tax, why it was used, what it has done to America from a counterproductive point of view, as well as the consequence of the Federal Reserve. He also helped us put the aggregate deficits of America into context so that we might understand how debilitating a place it is that America now finds itself. So returning to this study and trying to establish a firmer foundation, and the reason we're doing this, of course, is that Americans just did the unthinkable. At a time where the dominant issue was the economy, where the floundering American economy and its deficit outweighed every other debilitating aspect of American society by an enormous proportion, that Americans passed up on a man who was perhaps the most qualified economically to be president in the last century in favor of a man who has had zero experience in free enterprise, who hasn't so much as worked in a McDonald's. It is a stunning turn of events where Americans are no longer either able to decide between the lesser of two evils, or that Americans have finally reached the tipping point, which was Craig Smith's view, where we have gone now from the Declaration of Independence to the Declaration of Dependence, and that since the system has been jury-rigged so that 50% of Americans pay no tax, and those same 50% of Americans actually receive checks from the federal government, that we have witnessed now the bane of democracy, where it becomes mob rule, where it becomes the tyranny of the majority against the minority, and we are doing what Jefferson said would bring the end of our republic, which is when people come to the conclusion that they can confiscate money via the ballot box. So at this time, as we approach what is being called the fiscal cliff, by the way, this fiscal cliff, in perspective of the overall decline of the U.S. economy, its mismanagement and the resulting deficit is nothing but a flea on an elephant and donkey's behind. We are, again, as we have a tendency to do, focusing on a symptom of the problem rather than the problem itself. And during this time, it is the President of the United States that says that he is going to resolve the fiscal cliff, which is 90% a result of the impending increase in taxation that will result if they don't get their collective act together in Congress and the White House. He's going to resolve this international crisis that is brewing in the United States that will result in a sharp increase in taxation with taxation. The likelihood is that the capital gains rate will go up substantially, which will destroy any hope of economic recovery, and that corporate tax rates, which are already amongst the highest in the world, will be driven up further, as well as the tax rates on the most productive Americans. Collectively, this will bring about the very thing that we saw during FDR's first term, where he turned a recession into the Great Depression, all by deploying the exact same strategy. So it is in this light that it behooves us to understand the history of taxation and deficits, of economic upswings and downturns in the United States. So by way of review, the nation had very few taxes in its early history. From 1791 through 1802, the United States government was supported by taxes on distilled spirits, by carriages of all things, by refined sugar, tobacco, and snuff, and property sold at auction, particularly slaves. Corporate bonds were also part of that which was taxed. The high cost of the War of 1812 brought about the nation's first sales tax. This sales tax was on gold, which was the primary commodity of the day, on silver, on jewelry, and on watches. And then in 1817, Congress did away with the internal means to taxation, and it turned to taxing tariffs, duties on imported goods, to provide the funds for running the government. It should be noted that at this time, the largest expenditure of the federal government was a bribe. The United States paid a disproportionate percentage of its GDP to the Ottoman Empire to diminish piracy of its ships. You see, particularly in northwestern Africa and in crossing the Atlantic, American ships were attacked by Muslims who robbed them in concert with the Quran and Hadith. And when Jefferson went to try to resolve this problem amicably, what he found was that the Ottoman ambassador said, "It is our Quran, our Hadith, our Prophet that tells us that we are to do these things, to be pirates, to rob your ships. And we will continue to do so, but if you want us to diminish the amount of pillaging that we do of your property, you can pay us a bribe," which the U.S. government did during this time. Now, it should also be noted that bank failures and the introduction of paper currency, along with banks refusing to pay off their debts in gold or silver, it led to a two-year, 33% contraction depression in 1836 through 1838. This was followed by a three-year 34% contraction depression in 39 through 1843. The 1839 through 1843 depression was the longest in U.S. history up to that point. It was a direct result of the introduction of paper currency and of bank failures, but particularly of banks being able to manipulate the new currency by being unwilling to pay off their debts or return a investor's gold or silver. Now, the longest depression in U.S. history did, as so many depressions had a tendency to do, led to the United States declaring war. In this case, it was the Mexican-American War, which, because of the enormous amount of spending, it has a tendency to resolve short-term economic declines, but its aftermath is far more devastating than what was initially encountered. And so the Mexican-American War followed a many 6% contraction of the U.S. economy in 1847 and 1848. Then what we experienced was a failure of British banks and the first time collusion between them and their American counterparts, which led to a horrible depression with a 20% contraction of the economy between 1847 and 1848. During this time, inflation and rising interest rates became the de facto means of taxation, plunging the U.S. economy into another recession in 1853 and 54, with GDP diminishing another 18%. All of these depressions and recessions, as well as those which followed closely on their heels, can be traced to the ability to manipulate the new U.S. currency, with banks facilitating that by refusing to redeem notes for gold. You could give them gold, but they would not give it back. The loss of confidence in American banks and unsupported dollars prompted an 18-month downturn with a 23% contraction of the economy in 1857 and 1858. As you can tell, there are more years of recession and depression than there were years of normal economic growth. This occurred again in 1860 and 1861, just before the onslaught of what I would term the most uncivil of wars. And what we will find is that, like all wars, the Civil War in America was expensive, leaving America devastated in its wake. We'll return to this discussion of the destruction of the American economy and its manipulation after the break. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. Since this program is all about shattering myths, that we are now talking about the consequence financially of the uncivil war, let's make it clear that this war was not fought to liberate slaves. This war was fought on undemocratic principles. It was a period where any state could freely decide to associate with the Union, should it wish to do so, with the Union of states, but it could not disassociate. You could choose to join the party, but you could not walk out of the party, which was what the war was fought for. And as a result of eliminating choice, of precluding any state from deciding they didn't want to be part of the United States, over 600,000 American lives were snuffed out, and half of the nation was terrorized and utterly destroyed. And in the process, most of the constitutional guarantees were usurped by the President of the United States, who became a political icon, hero, if you will, almost worshipped to the point that he has his own temple and shrine in Washington, D.C., and his speeches are read as if they were scripture. But let's return just to the financial consequence of this war. It was expensive. It further destroyed the value of the U.S. dollar in the North and the means of production in the South. and its destructiveness, both by allowing the government to commandeer business for the purpose of making bullets and bombs rather than that which is productive, and by its staggering costs, which ultimately had to be paid, and by way of the lives and assets the military destroyed during this time, the war was followed by a long and nasty recession in 1865 through 1867, this one producing a 24% contraction of the economy. Taxation continued to come by way of inflation from a currency which was no longer backed by gold or by silver, although there was a new form of taxation in order to support the uncivil war. Congress enacted the first income tax law in 1862. During the Civil War, a person earning $600 or more paid tax at a rate of 3%. Additional sales and excise taxes were then added, and an inheritance tax, which is tax on the money you've been able to maintain after taxation, or a tax upon a tax, made its debut. In 1866, however, we find as a result of these taxes that collections reached their highest point in the nation's now 90-year history, where more than $310 million was received by the U.S. government. This was an amount that exceeded any amount confiscated by the government to pay its debts until the formation of the IRS and the Federal Reserve in 1913. The Act of 1862 established this Commissioner of Internal Revenue, which was the beginning of this confiscation of productive assets through taxation. The commissioner was given the power to assess taxes, to levy those taxes, to collect those, or to assess the basis for taxing, to levy taxes, to collect those taxes, and also the right to enforce the payment of its taxes through laws and seizures of both property and income. America was no longer free. These taxing mechanisms could well be to blame for the long and severe recession of 1865 through 1867 and the longer and still more debilitating depression, which began 6 years later, lasting 6 years. In this light, money manipulation by way of the 1873 Coinage Act, which depressed the value of silver and led to unemployment, labor unrest, and resulting union strikes, particularly on railroads, caused a 34% contraction and subsequent depression in the years 1873 through 1879. This was known as the Long Depression, and it was ultimately resolved by reversing the damage that had been done not only in 1873, but previously when banks refused to pay off their debts in gold with what was called the Specie Payment Resumption Act, where the U.S. returned to the gold standard and ended its many decades-long flirtation with fiat money, one in which recessions and depressions became so commonplace there were more of them than there were years of normal economic growth. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're reviewing the history of economic malfeasance in America, so that we have some understanding of the correlation between taxation and deficits, between taxation and economic decline, and how money manipulation vis-a-vis fiat money, where money has no tangible backing and can easily be manipulated, has a tendency to prompt economic downturns. So here we are after the Civil War. The Congress has imposed for the first time, a federal income tax. And then some 5 years after imposing the Commissioner of Internal Revenue in 1968, Congress transitioned its taxation efforts, returning to taxing tobacco and distilled spirits, to sin taxes, if you will, en route to eventually in 1872, eliminating the federal income tax, because the U.S. Supreme Court decided that it was unconstitutional. Their stated reason was that because it was not apportioned among the states in conformity with the limits of federal authority so designated within the Constitution. In 1913, however, that all changed. You see, what was now a purely Democratic Congress, with a Democratic president, this time Woodrow Wilson, the 16th Amendment to the Constitution enabled income tax to become a permanent fixture in the U.S. tax system. The amendment gave Congress the legal authority to tax income and resulted in a revenue law that taxed incomes of both individuals and corporations. Boy, taxing corporations would be then a taxation without representation, since corporations cannot vote. In fiscal year 1918, annual internal revenue collections for the first time passed the $1 billion mark, rising to $5.4 billion in 1920, adjusted for 1983 dollars, but you look at $5.4 billion compared to the fact that the federal budget today is over $4 trillion a year. With the withholding tax on wages, which was introduced in 1943, where government required businesses to be burdened with the job of collecting its taxes, the number of taxpayers was increased to 60 million, and that would be in 1943, under the purview of a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president. From 1868 through most of 1913, there was, therefore, no federal or state income tax, and without any income tax in 1913, the U.S. government, before the imposition of the IRS and the Federal Reserve, actually had a budget surplus of $37 million. With the introduction of the 16th Amendment, the highest progressive rate was set initially at 7% in 1914. But with 9 years of Democratic control of all three branches of government, surpluses turned to deficits in the years that followed the imposition of income tax. So what had been a steady stream of balanced budgets and budget surpluses, with the imposition of federal income tax, surpluses were transformed into deficits. The deficit in 1914 was $1 billion. It was five times that number in 1915, reaching $5 billion. It increased three times again in 1916 to $16 billion. So here's the imposition of the Federal Reserve and federal income tax. And what happened to the deficit? Did the surpluses and the bonus years that we had been seeing before that become even more beneficial to America? No. We turned surpluses into deficits of $1 billion, $5 billion, and $16 billion. But then in 1917, the deficit soared to $59 billion and then $74 billion in 1918. And you might say that while this is being reported in 1983 dollars, and that it rose because of U.S. involvement in the First World War, the only reason the United States engaged in the First World War was because of the primary beneficiary of the IRS and of the Federal Reserve, recognizing that J.P. Morgan had loaned money and had an exclusive arrangements for the acquisition of war materials in the U.S. for Great Britain, and that because Great Britain was losing the war, he convinced the United States, Woodrow Wilson in particular, in entering a scam to have the Lusitania sunk for the express reason of dragging the U.S. into a war that it had no involvement, nothing to gain, nothing to lose. The only losses that would have been suffered by Americans in World War I were to J.P. Morgan and his cronies. But in spite of that, it became the patriotic duty of Americans who were beguiled by their politicians, who were lied to by their politicians, to go fight a war for American honor in the mud and in the trenches where poison gases were dispersed, and as the recipients of the first hail of machine gun bullets, and it was a despicable affair. So yes, the deficits grew in those years, but only because of a war that was fought solely to benefit J.P. Morgan and the fellow bankers who conspired with him, including the Rothschilds and the banks in England, to create the Federal Reserve. In fact, it wasn't but 3 years after the creation of the Federal Reserve that the United States was fighting a war on behalf of the bankers. During this time of growing deficits, federal taxation increased from zero in 1913 to 7% in 1914 and 1915, and then from 15% in 1916 to a confiscatory 67% in 1917 and a debilitating 77% in 1918. So it didn't take long for politicians to reveal whom they would be fleecing, productive Americans, by how much, by three-quarters of their income, and for what purpose, to fight wars that enriched bankers. War is the ultimate control mechanism, one that makes it easy to rob the populace of their lives, of their property, and of their freedom. In less than 4 years from the time the Federal Reserve and its companion, the IRS, were established, America would be drawn into this disgusting war solely to serve the bankers' interests who had conspired to create both the Federal Reserve and the IRS. Real incomes, of course, declined during the recession of 1913 and 1914, and they did not recover during the Federal Reserve's first 4 years, making matters worse. In the fifth year following the Fed's and IRS's formation, a devastating depression gripped the nation. In 1918 and 1919, unemployment reached 25%, and the economy contracted over 14% during a seven-month period. The very thing the Fed was established to prevent, it had caused. Now, this would lead to the third Federal Reserve economic contraction and the second induced depression, which struck in 1920. This time, Americans found their GDP contracting by 33% with 38% unemployment. Just 7 years after the banking cartel and its taxing companion, the IRS, were imposed on the American people. While this debilitating depression only lasted 18 months, even with greater initial economic contraction and greater unemployment than were experienced at the onset of what is now called the Great Depression in 1929, in its relatively short duration, the model for extricating from recessions and building a robust economy in their wake was not only established, it was proven. Lower taxes. So any time you hear a politician say that lowering taxes, which will cause the economy as a whole to grow, which will cause the government to receive greater income on lower rates thereby turning deficits into surpluses, and you were told that that's been tried before and failed, you've been lied to. The entire campaign on the economy by one Barack Hussein Obama was a lie. The only proven strategy for reducing deficits and turning them into surpluses, for extricating a nation from depression and recession, is one and the same. Lower taxes, and do so immediately and by a substantial amount. Therefore, historically in America, as we shall see, there is a direct, irrefutable, and substantial connection between the Federal Reserve and IRS, as well as with the Democrat Party, with increasing taxes, resulting deficits, and sharp economic decline. Republicans took control of Congress in 1919 and produced a $7 billion surplus in 1920 by reducing taxes, initially from 77% to 73%, and ultimately to 25%. Republicans controlled all three branches for the decade thereafter, and they created budget surpluses of $11 billion with reduced taxation in 1921, and then surpluses of $6 billion, $4 billion, $6 billion, $4 billion, $5 billion, $7 billion, $5 billion, $4 billion, and $4 billion. These surpluses all from 1922 to 1930, all while lowering taxes from 73% in 1921 to 58% in 1922 and 23 to 46% in 1924 before going to 25% from 1925 through 1931. Shattering myths. We're in the midst of reviewing the correlation between rising taxation and rising deficits, between rising taxation and economic recessions and depressions, as well as lowering taxation and times of economic boon, as well as revenue surpluses. The exact opposite of what Americans are being told, that by raising taxes you will bring down the deficit, and that rising taxes do not have a negative influence over economic growth. The exact opposite of that is what is historically true. So during this time, one of the few times in American history where the Republican Party had control of all three branches of the U.S. government for a decade. In fact, it is the only time in American history where those who were conservative as it relates to government spending, conservative as it relates to taxation and regulation during that period of time of conservative government, the U.S. experienced its fastest growing economic period, a time where the U.S. economy grew faster than had any national economy in world history. Now, there are those who will say that, well, that was that the depression which followed was the result of the growth policies of the Republicans, and as a result of their low taxation and perhaps they would say lack of regulation. But exactly the opposite was the case. The collapse was not a product of growth. It was not even a product of of unregulation. The collapse that occurred, which was just another what would have been short recession in late 1929, was caused by exactly the same circumstances that caused the recession that America is now suffering its way through, which was that money through the Fed was made far too easily available to people. More recently, it was to buy homes. Back then, it was to invest in businesses. And the only reason for the difference is that Americans have destroyed its, America has destroyed its manufacturing capability through regulation and through taxation. So you can no longer have a depression initiated in America by the means of constraining the ability to invest in business. Now it is only by means of constraining the ability to invest in housing. And so the only difference between the onset of the most recent recession and the Great Depression was the mechanism that was manipulated was investment on business and the economy versus manipulation of housing loans. But in both cases, money was made far too readily available by banks at artificially low rates. When they constrained the money supply and raised the rates, the people who could not afford those loans were put in a position where they had to sell the assets that they had purchased with those loans. And when a massive percentage of people all go to the market to sell, then it drives the value of things down in supply and demand. And because of this manipulation of loans, the country entered the Great Depression, just as it entered the Great Recession during the waning days of the George Bush administration. Now, this recession would have lasted a year and a half as had the 1920-21 depression had it not been for what happened. The Democrats, in conjunction with the media, which was now controlled by Democrats, and you may not know that one of the great outgrowths of World War I is when the media prior to the war was unbiased. J.P. Morgan, to advance his desire to bring the United States into war and to make the military one's patriotic duty to support country in such war for his own personal malfeasance, acquired a monopoly of newspapers. And he had those newspapers all tell his story his way. And so by the time of the 1929 crash, he had a mechanism to blame the party who wanted to constrain government for the collapse. I am Yada. We'll return after the break.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a